We welcome everyone here this morning. We're always delighted to see a good group and those visiting with us. We humbly request that you linger a little afterwards to get to know you better. Can you hear me? No? Now? Okay. Our purpose this morning is to try to give you New Testament Christianity, nothing more, nothing less. And it's our sincere desire that that gets across to you. If you have any questions, we have to answer them afterwards. We encourage you to come to classes in the Sunday morning and Wednesday night. We're studying Mark Sunday morning and Psalms Sunday night. Tonight we'll be getting into the Holy Spirit, finishing off that with the gifts of the Holy Spirit. We encourage you to come back for that. And this morning we're looking at a series on foundations of Christian living. We're about to finish up the first section on the foundation commandments to love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your might, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And then we sandwiched into it last week with definitions of love. And so we looked at that. So we're getting into the second part of that, loving your neighbor this morning. From James 2, the context that was just read, if, however, you are fulfilling the royal law, according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. But if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. In looking at this aspect of really the second greatest commandment, which goes along with the Ten Commandments, the first four have to do with our devotion to God, and the last six have to do with their devotion to each other. So as we look at, you know, loving our neighbor, the various aspects we're going to be looking at, one is the quality of loving self. Notice you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That gives you a standard to go by. But the question is, how well do you love yourself, or do you love yourself properly? Assuming that God is commanding is something good for our neighbor, we must also assume that he expects us to know how to properly love ourselves. However, since we live in an era of dysfunctional families, perhaps it needs a little bit of an explanation, because too many people in the world apparently don't love themselves. We will look then at a few scriptures that will help us to understand what God means when he says to love others as we love ourselves. One very good example is an analogy of how husbands are supposed to love their wives as equated to how Christ loves the church. Now notice, Ephesians 5, beginning at verse 28, says, so husbands ought to love their own wives as, and I like that, you know, a little qualifier there, their own wives as their own bodies. This is for the world too, chastisement there. Love their own as their own bodies. For he who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh. And then it uses these descriptions, nourishes and cherishes. Yeah, it's a standard formula. To nourish means to feed the body. That's what you do normally. If we get hungry, we hardly think twice about going to the refrigerator and feeding ourselves. The word cherish here, kind of interesting, you know, what the translators do with it. It's just the other aspect of it. Basically, it means just to warm yourself. Especially as we're moving into winter time, most of us are concerned about putting something on, keeping ourselves warm. Notice in the context of James, the first chapter, where where it talks about the difference between faith without works and faith with. It talks about you don't just tell someone be warm and filled. Okay, so it has these basic meanings of just, you know, feeding yourself, making sure that you're warm, main concerns about taking care of yourself. Cherish, as a translation, is more of a metaphorical use of it. It gets into higher levels, which is, you know, maybe possible, but the standard is just keeping it basic. But we'll crank it up to that, you know, as we go through this. And this is just as Christ does the church. So Christ cares that we're nourished, that we're warmed, whatever, but he also very much cares that we have higher needs met. you know, as he tries to bring the concept of the church and what God does for us. If we consider the attention we give our own bodies and the care we take not to let them get hurt, I mean, some of us, you know, we get hurt, you know, a little paper cut, we have to put a Band-Aid on it. I mean, it's like we become the biggest babies in the world. We care that much for ourselves. Okay? So he's trying to say, yeah, how much do you, you know, look at yourself. How much do you care for yourself? What do you do without even thinking about it because you're looking after your, you know, your own? Okay? So, you know, consider the same thing now. If you really, you know, love your neighbor, you're going to give them that kind of same consideration. We may begin understanding what loving our neighbor entails. Think about the actions of nourishing and cherishing. If one looks after the interests of others, if they were their own interests. You know, Philippians 2, 3 through 4. I mean, this is used as an example. Look out for others as more important than yourselves. You know, that's just a lead-in to the example that's given to us by Christ, who was in heaven, had everything, authority, power, you know, whatever, and gave it all up to become not only a man, but also a servant of men. That's how much he cared for us. Right? One would love others than as themselves. And consider the golden rule. You know, in Matthew 7, 12. Now, you have to look carefully at this. If you haven't been through this with me before, most people quote the first part of this. Treat others as you'd like them to treat you. Okay. Actually, that's not the definition of the golden rule. You've only quoted half of it, and you can carry away with that a wrong understanding. Notice it ends up with, for this is the law and the prophets. Okay. What are you looking at as a standard of how to treat others? Okay. If you just left it the first part, treat others as you would have them treat you, and you put that out in the world, it's going to come back to you all sorts of ways. We use the example, if I was a masochist, and you'll find a lot of them in the world, how do you treat others? Well, since a masochist is someone who likes to be abused, they will probably abuse others. I mean, when they come up to you, instead of shaking your hand, they're going to slap you right across the face. Treating others as you want yourself to be treated. But that's not what it says. What it's looking for, as it adds this, is that, you know, what is the proper way to treat anybody? I mean, you think about, how does God want us to treat each other? Righteously, you know, justly, you know, lovingly, all that. You know, as you go through the list, you go, yeah, that's the way I'd like to be treated, okay? Then treat others like that. That's the golden rule. That's how you fulfill the law of the prophets. Okay, it gives us a higher standard, and that's what makes it golden. Higher standard than what the world would apply it to. Okay? So, you know, however we'd like to look after ourselves, start looking after others the same way. Maybe even better, according to, you know, Philippians 2, 3 through 4. It is a simple matter of putting yourself in another's shoes. If you empathize with other people, that is, try to see their life through their eyes, you will see what their needs are. You know, this is what you do to yourself. You know, you live life in your shoes, looking through your eyes. Okay. Now, take off your shoes, get into somebody else's, and look at life through their eyes. And then you can see what their needs are. Okay, this will keep you from doing, you know, just strange things to placate your conscience. And somebody comes up to you and asks for a handout, do you just give them the money and walk off? Or do you stop and look, you know, what is this person's need? If you just give them the money, are they going to take it out and buy drugs or, you know, alcohol or whatever? Then they really don't need the money. But if you start to concern about, you know, how can I help this person in a way that would be most beneficial? Can I take them out and, you know, get them a good meal so that they're, you know, get them back to health? You know, take them to the doctor, you know, have a good medical check over. You know, maybe find a job for them. You know, there's also ego involved. I don't want to make this guy a beggar the rest of his life. If I can give him some self-esteem and put him into a job, okay, now you start to see, you know, when you look properly, then you can do for him what is beneficial and what he really needs. Isn't that what you do for yourself? Okay, so who is my neighbor? A lawyer one time, it's like, you know, when you stop to think about all you might want to do, you might want to narrow the scope of who you do that for. And that's what the lawyer did. A lawyer one time approached Jesus and asked what he might do to inherit eternal life. And when asked what were the two greatest commandments, he quoted the two that we're dealing with. However, when Jesus stated that if he did love God and love his neighbor, he would live. Okay. Now, the lawyer, ever looking for a loophole, said, wishing to justify himself, and he thought he was doing both of these things, like the Jews did, but they had a very narrow look at it. Now, we've studied in the Old Testament and saw that God had a very broad look at, what a neighbor is. Any sojourner coming through, they were to be treated pretty much, like fellow Jews, even if they were of the nations. But the lawyer justified himself and gives the narrow view of what the Jews become of, they don't even look at their own anymore. We're looking in Mark, and Jesus is having to deal with the tax gatherers and sinners who the Pharisees don't even associate. They're their own people, and they're not helping them out. So you see, Israel at this time had a very narrow view of who the neighbor is. And so he said to Jesus, "Who is my neighbor? You tell me." Okay, he shouldn't have asked. Okay? Jesus replies with the story of the Good Samaritan. Yes, Jesus' question, you're going to get a story. That's bottom line. Okay, so Luke 10:30, most of us are familiar with it, but try to look at it through kind of different eyes. Most people think they know what a Samaritan is. We have Good Samaritan hospitals. We talk about the Good Samaritan. But what was a Samaritan? Okay. When we read the story today, we probably need to visualize a nice man doing good deeds. However, in that day, Samaritans were not viewed as in such a nice way. I mean, Samaria was a result. I mean, they called it Samaria. They didn't even call it Israel anymore. It was part of the 10 tribes that had been taken into Assyrian captivity. The cream of them, the princes and everything else, had been taken off. And the Syrians had come in, and later Babylonians and others, and they'd intermarried with the people who were there, so they were a crossbreed. They weren't true blood Jews. Plus, they adapted just a view of the Torah and butchered it a little bit. And they worshiped not in Jerusalem, but the golden calf at sometimes, in two of the districts of northern of Syria. So the Samaritans were considered contemptibly a mixed race with distorted views of worship. Okay. See John 4 and the woman at the well. Now read the story and visualize the helpful man as a person of a different nationality and another religion and see if you get the effect Jesus was going for when he asked, which of the three do you prove? Now, if you don't know the story, you have a man that was accosted by robbers. Yeah. A thief just takes what you have. A robber, kind of bashes your head in. So this guy was accosted by robbers, plural, and cast into the ditch. He was stripped of everything that he owned and pretty much left for dead. He was that hurt. Okay. So as he's lying there, the first person to walk by is a priest, Jewish priest. Cares not for the man. The next person that walks by is a Levite of that tribe, that the priests are taken from. Walks by the man, just leaves him there. Okay. Finally, a Samaritan comes by. Now, part of that looking out for others, if the man in the ditch was looking out for himself, and could, he probably would haul himself out of it, phoned home to get some more money, the wife to send him some more money, or friends, or his banker, or whatever. He probably would have dragged himself to a hospital and taken care of his body, and then gone and held up someplace for a couple of days until he got better. Okay? He couldn't do that. The Samaritan did it for him. Okay, got him out of the ditch, bound up his wounds as best he could, took him to an inn, paid for his stay there and his food and his lodging. Okay. What the man would have done for himself, what he could, the Samaritan did it for him. Okay. Now consider yourself in that ditch. You're the one that's robbed, near death. And some person from Nigeria who's a convert to Islam comes by. You want to be helped? he'll consider you the neighbor if he's a, you know, like the Samaritan. And would you do the same thing if such an individual was in the ditch? From another nation, half-breed, religion far different from yours, would you help him? Jesus says he's still a neighbor. No matter how far you want to twist this thing, he's still a neighbor. Other relationships require love. Love is not a thing you feel. It is what you do because it is the right thing to do in every circumstance. That's what we were looking at last week. You know, love gets the job done. It's not an emotional thing. You know, emotions go like this. You can't count on them. This is why a lot of the Hollywood people that buy into the romantic kind of love, you know, from their own movies, they believe their own reports. You know, you'll see them, multiple wives. You know, they fall in love really with the role, the person they're with. Think of Angelina Jolie, and you know, it seems like every person she's ever starred with, she kind of falls in love with him. She falls in love with the man, the person, or the role that he was playing. And a lot of, you know, our concept of love is that. It's imagination mixed with a lot of hormones and stuff like that too. But you're not doing a factual analysis of why you feel for this person. Okay, this is why the agape of the Bible is a rational thing, not an emotional thing. It's a mindset of wanting to do the right thing no matter what the circumstance, no matter what the person. You want to do the right thing. And that'll get you through a long marriage. You know, as things go up and down emotionally. So what it does, it fixes what is broken. If it's something wrong in the business, if there's something wrong in school, in one of your relationships with somebody, in your marriage, whatever, if you love, you will try to fix what's wrong. And mostly it's going to deal with someone who's a neighbor, but that takes in everybody. Okay? And it continues to strengthen relationships that need to grow. In our list of people we are required to love, yeah, God's going to make it hard for us. You know, we have to love our enemies. Hate wars do not stop until someone decides it is time to start loving. People need to love peace, to love their children, love other people, love a bright future for them before all wars are going to stop. If you are breeding and breeding people to hate one another, you're always going to have a war. I mean, in the Middle East, I don't know, I can't see an end to it. You can have all the talks you want to, but as long as people, you know, like Arafat, bringing up children in order to hate Israelites, and Israelites, you know, you're bringing up to hate others, anytime there's that feeling, you're never going to find peace. This is why God goes, no, your neighbor is everybody. I mean, when I go to other places, you know, the first things I ask is, anybody here not a relative of Noah? Okay, we're all cousins then. Okay, we're all cousins. We're all neighbors. Right? Where am I? Okay, in Romans 5:10, it says that while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son. Now, if you go through Romans 5, while we were sinners, which separates us from God, while we were enemies, which separates us from God, while we were helpless, God sent his son. Okay. That's the way he felt about his creation. All of us, you know, considered as neighbors. Okay. If we are to be like God, we need to learn to respond to others in the way that will get them to respond back properly. Let's see where we take it for that. Okay, put it here. You know, there's a logic to it. You may, if you're going by emotion, you're going to go by a gut reaction. And you're going to let your emotions take over. You just want to, you know, the expression is just, you know, kill everybody, make a parking lot of the Middle East, and let God sort out everything. But God says, no, it's your responsibility. Okay? You've got to fix things. And it makes sense, okay? Can you imagine two armies? I'll just pick two soldiers out of it, out of each one, and they're warring against one another. Okay? If this one happens to kill one of these soldiers, you know, what have you done? Well, you haven't fixed this that too much. And probably the one you killed has a bunch of relatives and friends. You know, we've got a lot of that kind of stuff in the United States, the old Hatfield-McCoy feuds. Those things never did die. In fact, that's the same thing that usually, you know, you kill one person from our tribe, we're going to kill the whole tribe. Indians used to think, in America too, used to feel that same way in California. That's the way they approach things. You know, if you're interested in a direct quote, you know, come and see me afterwards. But you know, you're making more enemies. It doesn't stop. And they'll kill some of yours, and so you make more enemies. But notice, if you start the other way, suppose you convert this person. Let me do this one. Converse this one. Okay? And now he comes over here. How's the situation change for the better? And perhaps he brings his family and friends. Now your side is growing. It's a lot nicer. And this side is beginning to deplete, not in a violent way, but in a good way. That makes sense. It's logical. It's the way it worked in the first century. You know, Churchill pointed that out. He said, basically, we're trying to start kingdoms by war and oppression and everything else. In the first century, the Son of God came and set up an earthly kingdom spiritually with no violence, and it's lasted for 2,000 years. Maybe we ought to get a clue. It worked. It's before us. But still, we have a tendency to put aside, oh, love, all that kind of stuff. It's mushy. I'm telling you, it's not a mushy thing. It's a reasonable thing. It's an intellectual thing. This is what Paul and Christ did in the synagogues. They reasoned with the people. They persuaded them. It was a thing of the mind. It is a thing of the logic. It makes sense. If you can just get people to understand that. It works. Bottom line. It is amazing how many people claim to be Christians and not only do not love their enemies, they don't even know how to love their loved ones. They don't know how to treat their kids right. They don't know how to treat their spouse right. They don't know how to treat their fellow workers right. They don't know how to treat their fellow Christians right. I mean, it's just, I've used the spouses before, you know, just the kids. I mean, a child growing up in a home, I mean, the parents love them. You know, they feed them, they give them clothes, they try to keep them up, you know, with the learning, the books and stuff. They send them to school. Higher education. I mean, no one looks after that child more than the parent. But at some point, the kid gets an attitude and starts rebellion. He's rebellion against, you know, the one or two people that love him most in this world and has provided everything. Go figure. It doesn't make any sense. But that's the world. That's sin. Sin doesn't make any sense. It's the way we react to things, though, because we live in the world. Instead of, you know, going off in a corner and starting to think, you know, think about it and figure things out. How do you really want it to work? In fact, one time, teaching a high school class, and after this one session, one of the parents came up to me and goes, "What did you teach my kid?" And I said, "What do you mean?" Well, this last week they've been the nicest kids, they've been helpful and everything else. And I go, okay, all I did was have them sit down with newspapers and look up what it's going to cost them to live in their own apartment, buy their own food, get their own insurance, pay their own utility bills, and then go look for a job that would pay for all that in the style they want to live. And suddenly they realized how nice they had it at home. Sometimes that's all we need to do, just sit down and take a look, you know, what our options are, instead of just getting rebellious. I mean, we do that with God. We get rebellious, not realize, you know, I don't want God in my life. Okay, well, go find your own planet with oxygen and stuff that grows. If husbands and wives loved each other properly, right way, patience, kind, whatever, there wouldn't be so many divorces. One more thing, love is when you have the ability and the power to take revenge and you don't do it. I mean, when you finally have your enemy in your mercy and you can do anything you want to, even kill him, love is when you don't do that. But you start working with them to make their life better, to make them a better individual. That's love. Not exercising your authority or your power or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of people that this is what the world is, you know, to subdue everybody else. God flips it and goes, no. When you've got the power, and at times you're going to have it over your kids, or you know, you're going to be promoted in the office or whatever, or in the military. Okay? The ability to take revenge and not do it. Isn't that what God does? Doesn't God have the ability to take revenge and doesn't do it? Matthew 5, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's the way the Jews had started to reinterpret things. But I say to you, love your enemy, pray for those who persecute you in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. How's God treating his creation? Like neighbors? Does he have the power to just reduce us to a burned out cinder? Yeah, I love that line from The Day the Earth Stood Still. God could just make this whole planet, you know, just something that, you know, blow away in the wind. But he doesn't. Of all the things we've done to him and against him and whatever, he doesn't do that. He still sends his blessings on the just and the unjust, the righteous and the unrighteous. Hopefully they'll get a clue. You know, Paul told those at Lystra and Derbe, it's like, yeah, he doesn't leave himself without witness. He sends the seasons. Hopefully that will turn to him, realize there's something benevolent looking out for us. Now, the rest of that quote, for if you love those who love you, what reward have you? And what inroads are you making? If someone has to love you first, you know, how small is your world going to be? I mean, if you're only friends with people that wanted to make friends with you, boy, I hope you like cable, because that's the only friend you're going to have for the rest of your life. You make friends by being a friend first. Okay? That's what God did. You know? But if you're looking for that first reaction, okay, God expects you to be proactive, to go out and do it first. Don't even tax gatherers do the same? And if you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect. Teleos. Perfect. Complete. Mature. Grow up. That's what growing up is starting to put yourself out in the world. You know, taking a little guff at times, taking a little punishment, taking a little bit of abuse, but to do the right thing because you're mature. Okay? You'll be as mature, complete, perfect as your Father when you start loving your enemies, when you start reaching out to others who haven't got the power to help you, but you can help them. Romans 12:9, let love be without hypocrisy, but devoted one another, but associate with the lowly. So far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. You know, there's a little qualify there. As long as it's up with you. You know, it's up to you, be at peace. Now, you're not going to be at peace with all men. Christ wasn't at peace with all men because they didn't want to be at peace. He did it to his ultimate, to be at peace with them. So as long as it's up with you, there's going to be peace. But when they don't want it, there's going to be some war. Okay? And God's going to bring it about. Be ready for that. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you'll heap burning coals upon his head. There is times in history, I don't quite remember fully this one instance, so I'm going to paraphrase it, and it might not have happened exactly that way, but you'll get the gist of it. The period of time, I believe, was World War I, and they were fighting trench warfare in Europe. And of course, you know, the Germans and the Axis and the Allies were going at it, shooting across it. But there was always a period of time when just everybody broke for lunch, you know, where there was kind of a little bit of peace over the battlefield. And there was one instance where there was a hurt enemy. You know, I'm not sure which side did this, but so I'm going to leave it, you know, open. One of the enemy was hurt, and one of the other guys, you know, got up out of his trench between the two armies and went across what they called no man's land at the time, and went out to this guy, and everybody kind of held their breath from both sides because they didn't know what this guy was going to do. They thought maybe he was just going to, you know, maybe bayonet the guy. But he got up to him, he laid his rifle down, and began to take care of him. Gave him some water to drink, bound up his wounds, picked him up, and started taking him to the enemy lines until some of their soldiers came out and got him. And, you know, both sides are watching this. Okay? And he hands him over and then walks back to his own lines. Okay? Nobody shoots him. I mean, they've been there all morning shooting each other, killing each other, but just one act of kindness kind of impressed everybody, at least for that day. This is God, what God's looking for from us. Having the courage to take that initiative, to begin to change the world a little event at a time. Greater love hath no man than this, that lay down his life for his friends. Well, consider friends your neighbors. Oh, man. Okay. We look at Ephesians 5, Titus 2, 4, encourage the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. This I can understand, you know, encourage them to love their husbands. I mean, husbands can be some jerks at times. But to love their children, why would you have to tell women to love their children? Isn't the maternal instinct there, you know, that it kicks in and they'll love their babies automatically? No. It's a societal thing. We think it's a maternal instinct because Western civilization based on Christianity has been around long enough where we just kind of pass it on from family to family. But now that Christianity is being pulled out of our society, more women are having abortions. They're killing the babies inside of them. I mean, the abortion law was passed because the judge thought the maternal instinct would kick in and the women wouldn't do it. Boy, was he wrong. No. Or they're leaving them in trash cans. In China, they just leave them on a hillside. They don't like the girls. They do that in the Far East, in the Middle East too, where boys are considered precious and women and the girls aren't. If you've got, you know, a large family and you're poor and you can't feed them, you just leave them out in the cold. Personally, I know when Nancy and I were first married, first work we went to, we're kind of still moving in, and the daughters came to visit. And at the time, I was very much a believer in, you know, maternal instincts. You know, but the little grandson, the first one, he was in the back in the middle of the night. He went off. You know the cries and everything else. And I'll tell you, in the middle of the night, I had to step over four women in order to get to that kid. None of them hurt him. So forget maternal instinct. God knows what he's saying. You got to treat your, you know, the mothers to love their children and to love their husbands and the husbands to love their wife. It doesn't come that naturally. It should, but it doesn't. And this is why Christianity is so valuable, because it's the one place where people learn to do that. Honor all men, love the brotherhood. I mean, look at the people around you. You have a problem living with them? These people are closer to you than anybody else on the planet, even your own blood relatives, because you got a bond in the spirit. If you can't get along with them, none of this is making an impact on you. Okay? Or whenever you speak the truth, do it in love to your neighbors, to whatever. The two have to go together. Okay, you can speak truth. People have spot truth and never show that they loved anyone. And the person won't listen. If you show that you love the person, and then you speak the truth to them. I mean, you can love them and tell them a lie, but the two make a strong companion. The truth administered in love. This is what God wants us to do. Okay, you've got handouts. If you didn't get one, you know, there's some in the back. This is meant as a class, but we can kind of use it here, you know, to bring you all up to speed on certain things. You can take this and teach it to other people, maybe your own family. You know, use it for a weekly study. Context questions, I'll leave that. Just go back over, you know, review the sermon by going through those. There's also study and thought questions, considering the full context of Matthew 7. the last part of the Sermon on the Mount, what is the real standard to use? You know, as you look at the Golden Rule, start with verse 1 and see if you can figure out really all that God is trying to tell us. How can we be perfect like God is perfect? We kind of helped you on that. I have a different definition for the word perfect. You've got daily readings. These will go along with what's going on. You have the loving others is loving Jesus. That's what he says. A cup of cold water given in my name. You're giving it to me. It's a way of perspective of thinking of things. Paul and Barnabas disagree, but they can resolve it because they love the truth. They love serving Christ. They do love one another. Paul rebukes Peter for the sake of all. There's some tough love going on here. He shows us how to do that. Love without hypocrisy. Loving the brotherhood, especially the weak. And doing the right thing through unjust times. You know, Peter gives us that. So look those over during the week. Keep track of it. And then there's the daily thing. We're still trying to see. Becoming a Christian is taking on new habits. And again, we're up to week 3. How are you doing on filling those charts out? Okay. Have you been praying every day, Bible study? But notice there's some sections here that are blank. We're coming up to it in the next couple of lessons. Some things to add there, especially concerning growing and other things should be considered. You can add to the list. But for right now, here's something to think about. We're about to sing, Have You Counted the Cost? Number 266. Get out of this. In counting the cost, one of the things that as we encounter other people in the world, most people think they're okay. And so one of the things you want to go through with them is the list of sins. I mean, there are several. There's like 2 chapters in Romans, chapter 1 and 2. You've got that in a Galatians, deeds of the flesh, 1 Corinthians 6, things that will keep you out of the kingdom. Just look at the enumeration of sins. Everybody's committed them, or parts of them in some way. If you've done just one of them, it's separated you from God. Now, count the cost of that separation. For people that keep putting off, you know, getting back in a relationship with God, if you count the cost of not coming into really what he's called a law of faith, where you don't have to live a perfect life under the works of the law that the Jews thought. You can just try to do the best you can, and then God, as a judge, brings you up in justification to the righteousness of his Son. Wouldn't you rather live under that law? You know, where you've got mercy and justice and all the things that God puts into us, so we don't have to be perfect. Okay. If you haven't entered into that covenant, you're still under a law of works, where if you violate just one part of the law, you're guilty of the whole law, and you're no longer in a relationship with your Maker. Now, if you haven't taken the time to do the right thing, to start serving God, have you counted the cost of that? Right now, you know, if it could happen anyway, perhaps, you know, the preacher goes berserk and decides to do you all in. You know, okay. This very minute, you know, now what are you going to do? What would happen, you know, if you walked out that door and, hey, I was in a congregation one time where 2 hours before the congregation met, some guy was driving down the street, worked all night, was a little bit sleepy and a little drunk, and he drove his truck right through that part of the church, right up to the second pew. If he'd come 2 hours later, he would have wiped out most of that congregation. That close you come. You're only a heartbeat away from eternity. And if it happens, and you're suddenly before your God, what are you going to do? Do you have a life of service to lay before him as your name in the book of life? Have you counted the cost if it's not there? Yeah, as an invitation, have you set things right? Are you prepared to go? And this is one of the things in the Old Testament, the Passover. As they ate their meal, they did it fully clothed with a staff in one hand, ready to go, because it could come at any moment. Is that the way you're living your life? That God could come any moment And if he does, are you ready for him? Is there anything we can do to help? You know, get you prepared to meet your God. Please let us know as we stand to sing.